man's pony was found wandering near Green Pass, and his checkered scarf was recovered nearby, snagged in weeds at the edge of a cliff. A fool could read the signs. The pony had slipped or shied, flinging Lantor Hingeman over the precipice. He was decomposing in some crevasse, or in the foaming river 1,000 feet below. The boys knew better, of course. Their father had staged his death. He had needed to disappear, and so he had. Neither of them would entertain another version of events for an instant. But the mystery only deepened. Why had the prophet called him back to Eternity Camp, and why had he responded to that call with such a charade? The answer came 16 months later, when Condrey lay recovering from his skull fracture in the army hospital. Diakra Hingeman had been allowed to care for him. She came with Nereti, 22 herself that year, and immensely helpful on the journey from Blind Stream, and Perch, their little brother, who was not at all helpful, but strangely insistent. The three of them stayed a fortnight. Diakra rented a shack in the village. Perch, now 11, remained a troubled child and still slept with a knife, but his behavior in the hospital was exemplary. Day after day he sat with Condrey and their mother and sister, never complaining, listening to talk he was too young to understand. Mektu joined them when his duties permitted, entertaining and infuriating the family by turns. Condrey had thrown him out when he asked a burn victim if he ever expected to enjoy grilled meat again. One morning, Nereti slept in, and their mother, after an hour at Condrey's bedside, excused herself to take a walk. No sooner had she left the ward than Perch leaned close to Condrey and whispered,
"The old man's gone to the desert, Condrey."
Condrey grew still. He stared at his youngest sibling for what felt like an age. At last he cleared his throat.
"He told you?"
The boy nodded sagely.
"Only me. Just before he faked his accident."
"Why you, Perch?"
"Because no one thinks I know anything. So no one ever asks questions. But I have a question, Con. Where's the desert? Can I walk there from Blind Stream?"
Condrey sat up and kissed his brother on the forehead. The effort sent a crazed bat of pain flitting around inside his skull.
"It's too far, Perch. Now listen, do you know why he left?"
Again the solemn nod.
"He didn't tell me, but I know. It's all Nereti's fault."
The boy looked over his shoulder, as if Nereti might have snuck up behind him. Leaning close to Condrey's ear, he said,
"I hate her. She says Mother's a heretic, and that Lord Jekka is going to claim her as a bride in hell."
"She said that?"
"And she was always nagging Papa. How he should be helping the war effort, how he should build things, for the army."
"Oh, gods," said Condrey. "No."
"She blabbed about him, too. I'm sure she did. Yeah, 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 my Papa can build anything." Until finally an army boss came to see him, a big man with medals on his chest. He wanted Papa to build war machines. He said, "Every Chiloto has a duty, Hingeman, and yours is mechanical."
"What did the old man say?"
Perch gave him a funny look. "Papa was not very nice. He said the prophet was well supplied with mechanical servants. I don't know what that meant, but it made the boss really angry. He told Papa to get his clever ass to Eternity Camp by the end of the week. Then he walked out without drinking his coffee. The next day, Papa left."
"And they really think he's dead, back home?" Perch gave him a fragile smile.
"Everyone but me," he said.
Condrey's headache was searing. He had not done so much thinking since the day of the massacre. He told Perch to wait for New Year's Day, and then to take their mother aside and tell her everything. By then, he reasoned, no one would be looking for the old man any longer. By then, it would be safe for her to know he was alive.
"But Perch, the desert's fuck... the desert's enormous, right? Didn't he say anything else about where he was going?" "A little bit."
"Tell me, for Ung's sake, before someone comes." Perch fidgeted.
"I was crying. I didn't want him to go. He said I'd been bellyaching since the day I was born."
"That's Papa," said Condrey.
He said that he had to go to the desert to put an end to some nonsense. I asked him what kind of nonsense. Do you know what he said to me?
Something nasty, I'll bet.
No,
said Perch.
He said, the nonsense that started because I was afraid.
2 hours to sunset. Chindelin, who has the last watch, is standing outside with his back to the ruined vessel. Condry crawls from the wreck and stands beside him. Cooler out here now, he murmurs.
So it is, says Chindelin.
He gestures with his head in the direction of the fortress.
5 hours we've watched that island. No movement, no sign that anybody's home. Mektu says the shadow of a bird passed over us, but that was hours ago.
He stands straight and looks at Condry.
Still no way to know, he says, whether we'd save or doom ourselves if we go up there.
True enough, says Condry. There is an uncomfortable pause.
I don't want the girl to die, Condry, but my first priority is you.
Condry kicks at the earth.
You think I'm a race hater, says Chindelin.
Are you? The smith frowns and looks away at the island. He begins to tell Condry about his parents' years in the distant south, before his birth. How his mother worked the edges of the Enfeipon jungles, keeping bees, tapping trees for latex, milling and boiling tetamura vines into brilliant blue dye. How his father cooked for 200 men on a logging crew gnawing its way through those same jungles. How they'd met at a dance. Condry, irritated, wonders how a single word of this addresses his question. He bends and looks back through the hole in the boat. His brother and Eshet are awake. She appears to be extracting a splinter from his foot.
I'm not narrow-minded, says Chindelin. I've seen a fair bit of the world. Not as much as your father, of course, but a fair bit.
Why didn't you two ever travel together? Condry asks. Chindelin is startled.
Don't you know? Lantor asked me to keep an eye on all of you. He wanted me in the village whenever he couldn't be.
Couldn't be?
Condry snorts.
Didn't choose to be, you mean?
Chindelin gives him a careful look.
How much do you know about his travels, boy?
Another irritating remark.
What do you expect me to know? Exactly as much as he wanted me to know, that's how much.
The days he left and the days he walked back in the door.
So you don't know why he went away?
Condry's toe digs a recalcitrant stone from the ground. I know he showed up with kids. He called them orphans, but half of them were probably his bastards, and I'm one more. He gave me his name because I was the first, maybe. Because my birth mother was the first. She was lucky that way. Chindelin shook his head.
They weren't Lantors, he says. You're the only one of his children not born to Diakra's womb. I thought he might have talked to you about the orphans, and other things. Before you enlisted, I mean.
We were a little distracted.
By Ari's disappearance. I know.
Both men stiffen. The air between them is suddenly harder, more laced with fear. Condry looks at his uncle, willing him to speak. This weapon maker, his father's best friend. Whose side would he take if it came down to choosing? Then Eshet calls from the wreck.
Where is Talupeke?
The men jump, bend to stare through the hole.
She was right there, says Chindelin.
I didn't ask where she was, snaps Eshet. Ong's tears, were you sleeping on watch?
No, says Chindelin. She didn't leave this way. I couldn't have missed her.
She must have climbed out through the cargo shaft, says Mektu.
Condry steps back. The girl is not atop the boat. He turns in a circle, scanning the horizon. Then an awful thought descending, he rushes to the stern.
Fuck a frog!
Talupeke is a mile off, running hard for the island. A single Fosca over her shoulder, salt dust shining behind her in the evening sun.
Idiot! Cries the smith. Come on, boy, let's go after her. Your brother can guard Eshet. He'll love that assignment.
No, says Condry.
What do you mean, no?
I mean, you stay right here, Uncle. Haven't you done enough?
Outrage and guilt in the eyes of the smith. Condry has no time for either. He dives into the wreck, snatches up his machete and headscarf. Moments later, he is off, the salt pan thumping underfoot like a whitewashed roof. His stride is longer than Talupeke's, but she has a big lead. He can see now that she will reach the island long before he can catch her. But what the hell is she doing? Leaving them after all? Or taking on the fortress herself, to make up for nearly beheading one of their party? She passes the first of the outlying shipwrecks.
Damn her.
If the army is up there, beheading is the best they can hope for. Darkness will fall in little more than an hour, but for now they are excruciatingly visible, their sharp shadows etched on the plain. Footfalls behind him. Condry's hand flies to his machete, but it is only Mektu, catching up, his loose scarf trailing behind him like a flag.
"Uncle's in tears," he huffs. "He's afraid she'll kill herself."
Condry lowers his head and runs faster. The thought has already occurred to him. Some suicides drink poison, others fall on their swords. But Talupeke? That mountain of rubble. She's going to climb it. Climb it to the fortress and... She reaches the mouth of the cove, vanishing at once among the black stumps of the fallen piers. 2 long minutes later, they reach the cove themselves, and in a matter of yards, they are wading in sand. Fine, wind-drifted sand, trapped like dust between the cliff walls. They flail on, weaving through the forest of stumps. High above, the fortress walls stand within feet of the eroded cliffs. Horrible, to be running beneath something so vast and precarious. Ants under the wheel of a cart. Then Condry sees her, already climbing the rubble mound. It is enormous, like the debris left by an avalanche, and at its top is the dark hole of the former gate. By the time they reach the mound's foot, she is halfway to the top.
"Turn around," Condry pleads as he climbs. "Just turn and see us. Don't force me to shout."
And she does turn, a few steps from the broken gate. She does not appear surprised to see them. Condry lifts his arms and shakes them desperately.
"Wait, there!"
She studies them, still too far for them to see her expression. Then she walks into the fortress.
"The bitch!" says Mektu. "What if she knows the army's up there?"
Condry looks at him sharply.
"Talupeke may be sick, but she's not evil. 2 minutes with her should tell you that."
Mektu flinches at the reprimand.
"You're right. I'm sorry. Sometimes I don't think it's me talking, Con."
Condry rubs his sore eyes.
"Let's go and find her," he says.
The climb is steep and awkward. When at last they near the fortress, they drop to their bellies and crawl toward the gate. Condry locks his eyes on the jagged hole. Among the many things it may confront them with is Talupeke's dead body, or Talupeke gagged and beaten in the hands of the Rasanga.
"A bow," thinks Condry. "Why didn't I grab a bow?"
What they find beyond the gate, however, is simply a courtyard, huge and stark. The outer walls of the fortress may be intact, but the interior, it appears, has been razed. There are knee-high rectangles of crumbled brick. The outlines of ruined storehouses or barracks or armories, remains of campfires, a shattered millstone, a rusted cauldron too huge and heavy for anyone to cart away.
"Pit fire," says Mektu. "This place has been dead longer than the sea."
They move inside. The shadows are long in the waning light. Against the east wall, stone stairs climb to the battlements. To their left, a square pit like a mine shaft plunges down into the hill. Nowhere to hide, he thinks, unless one leaped into that pit or curled inside the cauldron and prayed. But in the north wall are 2 stone archways, letting into another great court or yard. Beyond, looming high above over the fortress, is the broken tower. A soft sound to their right. The brothers whirl, then swear. Talupeke is kneeling atop the battlements, sweeping the telescope across the land. After a moment, She lowers the instrument and creeps toward them along the wall. The brothers meet her at the bottom of the stairs.
"No one to the east of us," she says. "The way is clear for you ahead."
"That all you have to say?" asks Condry.
The girl's red eyes have a fierceness that shames him. What does he expect her to say? She gestures at the twin arches.
"We'll need to go in there for a view to the north. Of course, your enemies could be in there. I doubt it, though. Nothing much to be gained from hunkering down in a closed courtyard. They could be in the tower, though."
"We watch that tower all day," says Mektu. "We watch the whole fortress. If they're here, they're not up to much."
"If they're here, they've seen us already," says Condry. "Come on, before the sun sets. A look around is the only damned reason for climbing this rock." They cross the vast courtyard as quietly as possible. Under the shroud of dust and salt, small objects resolve into view. A bent fork, a shoe buckle, a rusted length of chain. And suddenly, a human hand. They stop dead. The hand is a ruin. Scraps of flesh shriveled to rawhide on sun-bleached bones. Two fingers missing. A bronze ring about the thumb.
"Ghouls," whispers Condry.
Talupeke flips the hand over with her boot.
"You know how to fight them, don't you? A stab with your mouth closed, then a leap back to breathe. Don't inhale their stench. It can wither you like a curse. Like a cold wind withers flowers, my grandmother used to say."
"I can smell them," says Mektu.
Condry smells it too. Rotting flesh. The most evil, most unendurable smell in all the world. In silence, they approach the easternmost arch and flatten themselves beside it against the wall. Inch by inch, Condry leans out until he can steal a glance into the space beyond. Cold terror envelops him. Beyond the arch is a courtyard almost as large as the one they have just crossed, and almost as empty. Almost. Ranged along the west wall are four towering heaps of driftwood and brush, and atop the heaps are four nightmarish birds. They are twice the size of elephants. Their plumes are dust gray, but their naked heads and necks are a slick, raw red, and their hooked bills are black. They shift and flutter stiffly, as though newly awake. Bones, human and otherwise, lie heaped around the nests. Dangling head down from the nearest is the flayed-open carcass of a human being, mostly devoured, a skeleton draped in strips of cloth and skin. As Condry stares, one of the vultures stands and beats its wings, sending a storm of dust across the courtyard. Between its massive talons is an egg two men would struggle to lift. "People will call anything an ornak until they've seen one." He pulls his head back aghast. If they had chosen the west arch, they would be standing within 10 feet of those birds. No one breathes or hesitates. They simply retreat, past the gnawed hand and the cauldron and the pit. The courtyard feels endless. Only at the gate do they pause to look at one another. Mektu gives a whisper of a laugh.
"Ghouls," he says. "Couldn't it have just been ghouls?"
Talupeke's look is wild, hunted.
"We need to get off this island," she says. "And then away, far away, as fast as we can. Those are roosting females. If they catch our scent, they'll eat us alive."
"We shouldn't have come here," says Condry.
"You mean she shouldn't have? Don't start that, Mech. If we're quick, we can be back to the trawler before it's totally dark. And yes, girl, we want you to come back."
But Talupeke is holding very still, looking at a spot somewhere north of the ruined boat. She raises the telescope. Then she grins that same unsettling grin she wore when she learned that they had come from Eternity Camp.
"What exactly the fuck did you do to the Prophet?"
Condry snatches the telescope. A few miles to the north, three tawny, long-legged felines the size of ponies are gliding across the seabed, with two riders each upon their backs. He cannot see their faces, but he can see the white robes, the belts of scarlet, the weapons numerous and large.
Rasanga, he says, fighting to control his voice. 6 of them, on Sivkrin. Oh, Jek as hell. Eshet and Uncle don't even know. Or, says Talupeke, they're watching and know perfectly well. It's not as if they can run.
Mech, it will be over by the time we get there, says Talupeke.
Long over. And then they'll just kill us too. She speaks calmly. Khandri almost hates her for it, but her words are undeniable. Even alone, 6 Rasanga could slaughter 12 fighters like themselves. And these 6 are not alone. The Sivkrin, the Sandcats, are trained to leap on a man and disembowel him at a word. All true, and yet he runs. All of them run, sprinting through the last of the ruins to the slope, racing each other to their deaths. Even Talupeke, rushing to defend the man who called her a savage and a dog. Hatred, love, the gods' great comedies. I'm losing my mind, Khandri thinks.
Wait!
Cries Mektu.
They've stopped!
Khandri skids to a halt. The Rasanga have indeed reined in their cats.
The scope! Use the scope! Hisses Mektu.
Khandri raises the instrument, focusing desperately, and finds himself gazing at a Rasanga with a telescope of her own, trained directly on themselves. Oh, says Khandri. The Rasanga lowers her telescope. Khandri lowers his. Then the riders turn the Sandcats, abandoning the trawler, and begin to race like the wind toward the island. A place to hold. A corner. The broken gate is far too wide. The battlements? No exit from up there except a plunge over the cliffs, or a dive into the nests of the Ornax. The Ornax? Will they rise, feast on hunters and fugitives alike, or just circle, waiting for the slaughter to end? There will not be much waiting. The Sandcats are blindingly fast. 3 minutes, maybe, and they will reach the mouth of the cove. Another 5 and the battle will be joined. Talupeke wants to try their luck with the pit and whatever caves or dungeons underlie the fortress.
Tie our scarves. Make a rope. Let go when the rope runs out. Maybe it's deep and we're killed. Or maybe we ambush them, or find another way out.
Khandri forces himself to lean over the shaft. Blackness. Blindness. A fate worse than death. Mektu seizes his arm, steadying him.
Forget it, girl. Next plan. I don't fucking have a next plan.
They return to the gate. The Prophet's commandos are inside the cove, passing the last of the shipwrecks. He can see their weapons now. Jaw swords. Mataglins, axes, bows. Perhaps the pit after all. He shuts his eyes, and his mind fills instantly with blackness. He's drowning. He doubles over, vomits on the stones.
What? Is he panicked? Asks Talupeke. Some fucking soldier. Are you going to freeze? Leave him fucking alone.
I'm all right, Mech, says Khandri, although he isn't.
We need to run. We need a place to fend them off. Underground, says Talupeke. That's the only place, except maybe that tower.
Khandri straightens, looking at her. The tower, he says. It had one door, right? One narrow door? Talupeke nods.
It was partly blocked, and the windows were high off the ground.
How high? The other two look at each other, then at him.
What are you thinking?
Asks Mektu. The Sandcats have begun to climb. The Rasanga's eyes are calm, unblinking, their blades already drawn. Is it madness? Says Khandri.
Is what madness? Hisses Mektu. Talk! Talk for Ong's sake!
They are halfway to the summit. Khandri says nothing, in the grip of a preposterous idea. Mektu, horrified by his stillness, slaps him hard in the face. It is the right thing to do. Khandri seizes their arms and pulls them wordlessly into a run. Not for the pit or the stairs to the battlements. For the arches across the courtyard. It must be the West Arch. The gods help us. The West Arch and silence, or we die. 20 feet from the arch he stops them. Turns back to face the gate.
Don't move until I do, no matter what, and don't either of you make a sound.
Let's put our backs to the wall, at least, says Talupeke. If they get behind us, we won't last a minute.
We won't have to.
Condri scans the rubble near their feet, scoops up 3 broken bricks. He gives 1 to each of the others.
Don't waste these on the Rasanga, he says. Keep them until... Oh, devil's ass. Steady, fuckers. Steady.
The sandcats are padding through the gate. 3 sinuous predators, hissing, bearing 8-inch fangs. The riders on their backs have painted foreheads, white stripes for mourning, green for revenge. 3 men, 3 women, all 6 enormous, muscled like gods. Without sound or hurry, they advance into the courtyard. They ignore Talupeke, but gaze at the brothers like starvelings approaching a feast. At the lead is a woman bearing a war axe, double-bladed and black. At a distance of some 100 feet, they rein in the cats, and 2 of the riders slide to the ground. Each carries a cruel, hooked mataglin, and wears, strangely, a single iron gauntlet on the opposite hand. Before Condri can even wonder at the purpose of these gauntlets, they burst into flame. He feels his brother's twitch of horror. The flames, blue and orange, writhe like fistfuls of snakes in the Rasanga's hands, but the warriors show no sign of pain. Their eyes, unblinking, do not leave the brothers for an instant. Their leader lifts her axe and speaks.
Condri Chamkara Hingeman, Mektu Malachat Hingeman, you who shed the blood of the sons of heaven, you who spit on the mother of us all, you traitors to 500,000 Chiloto, you beloved of the Lord of Hell, surrender. It is the last act of wisdom you may take in this world.
Condri's grip tightens on the other's arms. The woman's voice is sibilant and low.
You may say to yourselves, we are Chiloto also. But that is not true. The prophet has cast you from the clan, and she has ordained that every Chiloto man, woman, and child learn your names, the better to curse them. Curse you. Speed the punishment of your souls. Surrender. Embrace her justice. Name the foreign prince you serve, and your agonies will be reduced. There is no other path.
Condri is cold, and his flesh feels remote. He cannot control his heart. But in a slow, deliberate motion, he releases Mektu and lowers his hand to his crotch. His voice is barely more than a murmur, but in the windless yard it is enough. Her radiance. I wish her death. She's a prostitute, a whore. She goes with animals. She gives diseases to her sons. The commander snarls an order. Spurred heels kick, and the great cats hurl themselves across the yard.
Wait, hisses Condri.
Mektu and Talupeke look feral, deranged. Once more, he grips their arms.
Do you see it? Doesn't matter. 40 feet. Wait for them. Wait. Now!
They turn and sprint for the arch. Behind them, the Rasanga scream out the kill song of the Army of Revelation.
Ur-lulu-kra-lulu-ke!
And no more. Their voices obliterated by a hideous, torn metal shrieking, so loud it is like a kick to the chest. Over the wall between the courtyards, the ornaks rise, dark wings blocking the last of the sun. Terror grips the sandcats. The Rasanga haul savagely at their leads. The brothers and Talupeke plunge through the arch, so fast that Condri all but impales himself on the closest nest. No reason to throw the brick. He brings it down like a hammer, feels the eggshell crack. He spins away, flailing for the tower like a madman, expecting at any second to feel his spine snapped, his body lifted and torn like the corpse flashing by on his left. The startled ornaks have risen high over the courtyard. Now they dive, screaming. The tower so distant, the narrow doorway half buried in stone. Talupeke screams.
Condry whirls. She is lifting away from him. He leaps. They lock hands. They are both rising. Three humans are rising. The vulture has pounced on a Rasanga, and the warrior has Talopeke by the belt. The ground falls away. Talopeke's clothes are burning. The Rasanga has seized her with a fire gauntlet. She arches and kicks, but he is behind her. Condry cannot reach him. She is screaming. The Ornak gulps, and half the Rasanga vanishes into its beak. A talon rises long as Condry's forearm. He swings his machete and just stops it from disemboweling the girl. The beak closes. The gauntlet goes limp. They fall. Black wings. Bellow-churned air. Talopeke is torn from his grip. The head of the bird, enormous and obscene as it stabs at him mid-air, and missing by so little that the dead man in its beak grazes his lips with a burning finger. But where's the ground? The fucking ground that will kill him? Crack! Driftwood shatters. Brush explodes. He has struck a nest. It has saved him. He writhes in the bird shit and feathers, seeking solid ground. He's gone mad. A thing of slime and cinders rises wailing beside him, wielding two knives. It's Talopeke. Yolk-drenched, no longer burning. She has shattered an egg with her fall. Get up! Get up! Don't fucking stab me! They're on their feet, sprinting again. Somewhere, a cat is screaming. Blood is pouring from the sky. Then suddenly, he can scarcely believe it, they're at the tower door. Mektu gesturing from within. Aang still loves them. Talopeke dives through the gap. A shadow. Condry flings himself away as an Ornak strikes the stone like a battering ram. Within him, something accelerates. He sees nothing but beak and claws, the bird's great killing devices. He rolls, kicks off its leg. His machete is gone. The beak strikes. He twists away. When the vulture makes a hopping turn, he dives again for the doorway. Agony. He's dragged backward from the tower. The reek of death envelops him. He is rising. He is in the vulture's beak. For an instant, there is nothing in the world but that beak and the yellow pool of the Ornak's eye. Then release and the bird's sounds of agony, and Talopeke's knife buried deep in the eyeball. He strikes the ground. He scrambles backward for the door. Hands seize him, lift him, drag him into the dark. Blades! Blades! Mektu is shouting. If one of those shits fights his way in here... One of them does. The screams come from the floor above, mingled, indecipherable. They race up stone stairs into a scene of horror. A sandcat wedged in the narrow window, its hindquarters still outside the tower, and trapped against it a Rasanga, her cheek cut to ribbons and her leg caught in the twisted stirrup like a tourniquet, reaching back with her only remaining weapon, her war axe, trying to saw herself free. It is the leader, the one who spoke their names. If she frees herself, we die. Some of us. All of us. The mayhem is like nothing Condry has ever faced. The whirlwind of claws, the spit and fury and feline screams. The astonishing skill of the Rasanga, holding off all three of them while being thrashed against the wall by her mount. And somewhere above, Ornak's landing, ripping at the tower, trying to tear the structure apart. They cannot best this woman. She fights them all, shouting Dogri, abominations, as the walls tremble and the pool of her own blood widens on the floor. Above, the ancient timbers supporting the ceiling start to crack. Stones plummet. Dust blackens the room. For several moments they are fighting almost blind. Then the sandcat gives a piercing wail. An Ornak has seized it from behind. The Rasanga looks over her shoulder, sees her death in the darkening air. Together with the cat she is hauled backward, one sharp jerk after another. Her arms braced uselessly against the window, her mount's claws cutting grooves in the stone. And then she twists and brings the axe down and severs her own leg at the knee. The cat is gone, its screams extinguished in an instant. The warrior keeps her balance a moment, even lifts the axe again, and then falls, thrashing in her own blood, the weapon gone from her hand. The prophet! She is frothing, spitting her final words. Freed us! Freed your ancestors! Without her, you would not exist!
she lies still. Outside, the battle rages. Stones plummet from the roof. They descend the stairs again, praying that the ceiling holds. Through the doorway, they see the scarlet courtyard, the broken eggs, the bodies like rag dolls torn by spiteful children. And Mektu turns to Khandri with something like admiration in his eyes.
Six down, he says. Half a million to go.
They stand on rubble. The inner floors have collapsed. They can see right out through the stone funnel to the darkening sky. The Ornaks scream and flap and take the spire in their talons, dislodging bricks that whistle down the shaft and explode. They press themselves to the walls. Splinters of stone pelt and cut them. In time, the Ornaks' furies cease, but they can still be heard in the courtyard, ripping and feeding on the dead.
"Jashar Khan," whispers Mektu in the darkness. "You called the prophet a whore."
"I'm sorry," says Khandri.
"Why the hell should you be sorry?"
"I don't know, but I am." It is the simple truth. He has completed a process that began with his wound in the Galsune campaign. He has torn out a part of himself, a shameful part, maybe. But what mortar will ever fill that hole? He looks out across the courtyard. Halfway to the arch, a small fierce fire dances, blue and orange. It is one of the Rasanga's gauntlets, still attached to an arm, still fed by whatever arts or curses the prophet lends these most faithful of her servants. He can almost imagine that the arm still lives, that those blazing fingers will drag it slowly toward the tower as they sleep.
"We're better off, aren't we, Mektu? Better with it all torn out by the roots?"
"Shut the fuck up, Khan. You sound crazy."
A long pause. Then Mektu speaks again.
"You had to provoke them, to be sure that they charge. And of course we hate the prophet. I mean, the thing she is today. Not what she was, the savior of our people, blessings on her soul."
"Now you both sound crazy," says Talupeke.
"It's something only Chilotos understand, girl," says Mektu. "And anyway, Eshet's a whore."
"You piece of shit," says Talupeke.
"Was, I mean, a whore."
"Be quiet now, Mek," says Khandri.
"No, I'll keep talking," says Mektu. "I can't say these things to Eshet, or when Uncle's around to call me a fool. But I dream each night of that Parthen. Don't laugh. For the second time in my life, I'm in love."
"What happened to the first lucky girl?" asks Talupeke.
Mektu ignores her.
"She has a secret, Eshet does. You don't really think she just happened to show up when you killed Ojulan, do you?"
Khandri frowns at his brother.
"Of course I do. What else? What the hell are you saying?"
"She kept something from us," says Mektu. "She's not just a runaway whore. And don't lecture me. I don't judge or think less of her for whoring. How could I? Look at the refuge we chose."
"The army?"
says Talupeke.
"No,"
says Mektu.
"Belief."
At dawn, Talupeke sheds her boots and scales the inner shaft with the ease of a gecko. Khandri sees her standing fearlessly atop the broken spire, leaning a bit into the wind. After a long look in each direction, she scurries down again.
"All clear," she says. "They must be scouting, finding out if there are more of us. But they'll be back soon. We should run."
And run they do, across the sticky flagstones, through the reek and the flies, stopping only to recover what weapons they can. Khandri tries not to look at what remains of the six who came to kill them. The black gauntlet has stopped burning at last, but they avoid it all the same. When they spill out through the gate, they see one of the Ornaks circling far away to the south.
"Do you know what's fortunate?" says Mektu. "If others come here, looking for us, it won't even matter if they recognize the scraps, the cloaks, the belts, the Sivkrin hides. They'll blame the Ornaks, naturally. They'll never know we were here."
"It won't make any difference," says Talupeke ambiguously.
Then she looks hard at the brothers.
"She can't do it, can she? Order every fucking Chiloto in Urath to learn your name and curse it?"
"Sure she can,"
says Condry.
Where the fuck did she come from?
The girl almost shouts.
How did she dream up all this crazy shit? A path to heaven, godlike sons, all Uroth ruled by one Chilodo family, madder than moonflies. You two are Chilodos, but you're normal people, too. Sort of normal. You say you hate her now, you don't believe in her cause, but do you believe in her powers?
Who will answer first? Neither, as it happens. The silence holds all the way to the wreck. As they draw near, Chindelin emerges from the hull. An incoherent whoop, joy and disbelief at once, bursts from his chest. Eshet joins him, and the two rush out onto the scree. The Parthian woman's eyes are bright.
You should be
dead, says Condry. You don't know the half of it.
We saw the Ornax, says Chindelin. How in the flaming pits did you escape?
They sketch the events of the night before, and Chindelin hugs them, one by one.
Brilliant, brilliant, he says. Gods below, we were grieving already. Now come and eat something, and let's get the hell out of here. Together, of course.
He is glancing at Talupeke, wringing his hands. Eshet watches him intently. Talupeke shrugs and brushes past him into the wreck. The smith's gaze drops to his toes. Squirm, you old fool, thinks Condry. I hope Eshet chewed your ass off all night. But her face shows only relief at their survival. When Mektu drops to the ground to empty sand from his boots, she actually tousles his hair. She lifts her eyes to Condry, beaming, and touches his arm. But even as Condry smiles in turn, her face hardens.
Congratulations, Chilodos, she says. It's your holy day.
Mektu freezes with a boot in his hand. Condry, bewildered, turns to Chindelin. The smith gives a reluctant nod.
She's perfectly right. It's Revelation Day. I'd lost count. Funny how that happens.
Revelation Day, the anniversary of the prophet's first communion with the gods, and her declaration of war.
Not quite the same as last year, is it? Adds the smith.
Mektu lies flat on the earth, staring up into the cloudless sky. Condry feels Eshet's grip tighten, helping him balance.
No, he says. It's not much like last year.
Well, what the fuck happened last year? Asks Talupeke.
Condry turns his head away. He does not want to see the girl, or Eshet with her accusing eyes, or Chindelin with eyes full of kindness. Only now does he realize that he has been dreading this anniversary, the 51st, dreading the memories it will not let him avoid. Talupeke turns to Eshet.
Why are you the one who remembered anyway? You're no Chilodo. What's the profit to you?
An enemy, says Eshet. Isn't that enough?
Condry walks to the far side of the wreck, trembling and ashamed. He's not weak. He's just come through carnage, spent the night in a tower full of blood and piss and shit and flies, scraps of dead men and animals. But this is different. Revelation Day. No, he can't look at anyone just yet. Not even his brother, when Mektu shuffles up beside him and takes his hand. It had begun with mind-shattering noise. Steel hammer, brass bell. Their captain was storming through the tent, issuing orders in a non-stop howl. The bell was the signal for mobilization. The 50th Revelation Day would not be a holiday in any ordinary sense. The world was black and frigid. Dawn was still far off. Nonetheless, in 20 minutes flat, dressed, armed, stuffed with food, his unit assembled and marched for the north gate, heads held high. Condry was anxious. Their breakfast had included sutsak, a hot fermented drink normally reserved for mountain units. Brewed with honey and aromatic herbs, it went down easily, but the lingering taste was strange and heavy on his tongue. Adding to the strangeness was the behavior of his commanding officer. The captain was known for decency and a genuine concern for his men, but he had been irritable for weeks now, and had pushed Condry's unit like never before.
"The war front's waiting, you dogs!"
he'd snapped just yesterday, without provocation.
"You'll be back there before you know it, and the slow-arsed among you will be cut to shreds."
But this morning Condry's greatest worry was his own heart. He knew he should feel nothing but pride and awe on this day. 50 years of revelation. 50 years since the gods allowed her radiance to perceive their greatest secret, heaven's path, the silver-paved road of glory that would transform the world. 50 years since she swore on the Well of Fire that Chilotos would never again be slaves. Pride, awe, and joy, of course. For the enemy was in retreat. The Chiloto heartlands were once more ruled by Chilotos, and the war's end surely could not be too far off. "So stop wringing your hands, you fool. You're a good soldier. You feel everything you should." But was it enough? Did his joy truly match the greatness of the day? By the light of the security lamps, he saw Mektu and his friend Batali, whose ears stood out from his head like the wings of a grouse. Both men were smiling, beaming. Suddenly aware of his own face, Condry smiled in turn. It felt like donning a mask. How would the great day be celebrated? No one in his unit knew a thing. Condry imagined speeches, martial music, parades along the victory route. But nothing prepared him for what he saw outside the gate. Countless thousands were on the march. Pikemen, breachers, axe-wielding jindits, lowly sandalmen with their chipped blades and rusted halberds, bricklayers, sappers, the Akoli militia, the scarlet-sashed Orthodox guard, and the Rasanga, aloof and terrible, and other elite forces Condry could not identify. Everyone, in short. The prophet was emptying the camp. But the crowd was not limited to soldiers. Common Chilotos, farmers and townspeople were everywhere. They had swarmed the local village and overflowed into the fields. They had erected tents of their own outside Eternity Camp. Ong's blood, thought Condry. They must have been arriving for days. The great throng flowed northward over the wind plain, murmuring like a river in flood. No orders were shouted. No officers addressed them at all. Far ahead, at the vanguard, it seemed, a single kettle drum was booming, a lonely sound, a heart in a vault. For many hours they marched to that drum. Fields were trampled, villages swallowed whole. Rumors buzzed like flies through the ranks. Some said that they were making for Hunger Cliff, where the prophet came of age as the common-law wife of the warlord Bitruk Ulsor, and later experienced the vision that would change the world. Others whispered that a great engineering project lay ahead, something at which thousands had toiled. At daybreak, the whole throng knelt in prayer. In the vast, loving silence, Condry asked the gods to watch over the souls of his grandparents and the child Payar they had tried to save, 3 martyrs brutally killed by the Vajeks. But his prayers were over before anyone else's, and long before the signal to rise. He waited, motionless. Once again he could taste the heavy suit sock, and once again his worries pounced. The captain was right, of course. The front was waiting. At month's end, his legion, one of the smallest, was to march on a clan he'd never heard of before, a clan known as the Galsune. There were dark rumors about the mission. Several officers, without explanation, had been quickly transferred to other legions. Men were saying that they had requested, even begged, for the transfers. They're afraid, Condry thought. They know something that's been kept from the ranks. They know what we'll be facing and want no part of it. No. He glanced at his comrades, still praying fervently, their faces serene. What was wrong with him? In his mind's eye, he saw the face of the All-Shepherd, Father Mars, an enemy of the Hingemans, but a great favorite of her radiance. He thought of the way the hunched old man had squinted at them from the courtyard gate as they stumbled from the barn after all-night lessons. If Mars hated his family, wasn't his family in the wrong? Moral correction, That was what Mars had always preached. True self-criticism in the deep stillness of the soul. Had he, Condry, ever attempted it sincerely? What if he was too far gone even to try? He panicked. Faith was leaving him. The prophet's love was leaving him. Her holy eyes would turn away in despair. No, no, no! With an immense effort, he silenced his doubts. And in the void, he recalled the words of her first encyclical, committed to memory by every new recruit. Study the mirror, my children. When you walk heaven's path, you must descend before you climb. Down it leads through lightless depths, through the valley of the Gorgon, the black wood of the ghouls. Follow me, fearless, and you shall know the strength that is your birthright, and your true people, and the love that fear has kept from you. In the caverns of the soul, like the caverns of the earth, there is a well of sacred fire. Lift the cup with me. Dare to drink.
Hingeman!
His captain's voice was soft but imperative.
Get up, lad. We're moving out. And take the cup from your comrade there. Drain it. You're the last one to drink.
Condry rose. A cup was thrust into his hand. More, Sootsak. He drained it dry. The taste was exactly like what had been served at breakfast, but this time he found it good. Startlingly good. Instead of heaviness and dread, he soon felt a deep serenity. From across the ranks, his brother glanced his way and smiled, crazed and earnest. Condry smiled back, and this time nothing was forced. As they marched on, he recited the rest of the first encyclical and moved on to the second. And so the hours flew by. Mid-afternoon, their numbers doubled. Four entire legions, recalled from the various war fronts, met them at a crossroads, along with still more civilians. The two throngs became one whispering, northward gushing sea. Here and there, among the common folk, songs broke out, but they died quickly. Only the lone kettle drum, that steady heartbeat, played on. The sun sank low. Condry became lightheaded. They'd eaten nothing since breakfast, but he didn't mind. In the prophet's army, everything happened for a reason. The drum fell silent. Condry looked up and felt a tightness in his chest. Before them rose a hill, tall, barren, solitary, and on its summit crouched a sinister ruin. Whispers of awe swept the ranks. They had come to the Theater of Bones. It was a coliseum. Ancient and gigantic, six levels of tall stone arcades. Many were crumbling. A few had collapsed altogether. The place was long abandoned. The men of Condry's unit nodded to one another. Their captain had spoken at length about the theater some weeks before, about the time his behavior started to change. Now he beckoned his 60 men together, raked them with a manic stare. And to their astonishment, he screamed at them. He, their captain, a lone voice above that multitude.
Are you going to be fit soldiers today?
Yes, sir,
his 60 answered, abashed.
Come again? Are you going to make me proud?
Yes, sir.
The man's lips worked in fury. A vein stood out on his neck.
Did I hear a fucking crow in the distance? Where in Jekka's entrails are your manhoods? This is where your ancestors were gutted, you prize pigs. This is where they tried to end us all. Now speak the fuck up. Are you ready to stand proud under the gaze of everyone who's made this journey today? Every widow, every grandfather, every last warrior in the Army of Revelation?
In unison, they screamed at him.
Yes, sir!
The captain whirled. A flag was thrust into his hand, and he set off, waving it in a great arc above his head. And the multitude fell back like parting curtains, and Condry and his comrades advanced on the hill, and their fellow soldiers cheered. To either side, comrades rushed up to them, offering new uniforms, not hand-me-downs, but pristine coats, never worn by anyone. And before they left the throng behind, all 60 had shed their tattered rags for these bright blue and golden raiments.
They were not practical coats for warfare, but they were spectacular. As if in a dream, they led the throng up the hill, right to the foot of the Theater of Bones. A moat surrounded the Colosseum, 12 feet deep and bristling with spikes. An acrid smell, like oily paint or turpentine, wafted from the entire structure.
"Circle round! 10-yard intervals! Stand at attention!"
their captain bellowed.
"You're the honor guard tonight."
The 60 men raced to comply. They staked out positions and turned their back to the moat, weapons drawn, facing that sea of souls. And then they waited. All of them. 2/3 of the entire Army of Liberation, it was said, and an equal number of common folk drawn by the rumor and fascination. The sun set. The darkness deepened. Condry and Mektu glanced at each other, smiling still, floating on the wonder of the privilege they'd been given. But an hour passed, and then another. And although Condry fought it with all the strength he could muster, the sense of dread came for him once more. The theater was an abattoir, after all. Within those arches, the captain had explained, great rings of stone descended to a central fire pit, a crucible, with air shafts beneath it to feed the blaze. The Khosrajis had built the place to strike terror into the hearts of the fractious Chilotos. When the empire fell, the Vajeks seized control of the Chiloto lands and saw at once how useful this circus of horrors could be. During the last years of their rule, the stream of arriving prisoners was almost constant. The theater's very shape was a blasphemy. Condry's people built open tombs, much like the theater, but a fraction of its size. Every significant town built one. Smaller villages shared a single tomb. Inside, upon those stone rings facing the skies, the Chilotos laid out their dead. Washed, blessed, prayed for, unclothed. For the birds to pick clean. Other clans thought it gruesome, but for Condry's people the rite was holy, a return to the earth. At year's end, the bones were gathered and burned in the central pit. Ashes from the many tombs were exchanged, mingled, sealing the bond between villages far and near. And when the pilgrim, that great second moon, next appeared over Ispralal, the ashes of 21 years of Chiloto dead were thrown to the wind, or spread over farmland, or poured with prayers into the sea. In death, the Chiloto people were one. But their enemies brought no corpses to the Theater of Bones. Instead, Chiloto prisoners were marched to this hill, driven over flimsy planks spanning the moat, and forgotten. In that circular jail they were left to starve, or to make whatever end they could. Many climbed to the highest arcades and begged their captors for mercy. Finding none, they leaped. The able-bodied might get a running start and try to clear the moat. A few succeeded. The guards kept poles handy to nudge their shattered bodies back upon the spikes. Over the decades, ghouls infiltrated the structure, feasting on the dead and harrowing the soon-to-die. The Vajeks had watched them at twilight, chasing men and women in circles around the arcades. It was an entertainment, this place. In some seasons, tickets were sold. 3 centuries of mass murder. 50,000 killed in this structure alone. Whole territories of the Chiloto heartland emptied of life. And their numbers not yet half recovered. "My prophet," Condry thought. "What if you'd never come?" He was trembling with emotion. His head was not quite right. Then he jumped. A weird, thin sound, the hiss of some night creature, perhaps, was issuing from the structure behind him. A cracking sound followed, like a stick broken over someone's knee. He looked at Mektu, but his brother still stood rigidly at attention, the perfect tin soldier, although his body trembled a bit. Condry glanced at the theater with loathing. Most remnants of the occupation had been summarily destroyed, but not this one.
"Her radiance has something in mind for the theater," their captain had said. "She's kept it sealed and guarded since the start of the war.
totally sealed, you understand? The bones of the dead are still in there, untouched.
That was the shocking thing. All those bones.